From The Conversation, this is Politics with Michelle Grattan, a podcast where we hear from politicians and experts on the issues of the day.
Ken Wyatt, appointed in the re-elected Morrison government as Minister for Indigenous Australians, has presented his policy priorities in his first major speech in the portfolio, which he delivered at the National Press Club. He aims for a referendum in this parliamentary term to put Indigenous recognition into the Constitution. That timing is provided that there's agreement on a model and that there seems enough support for the vote to be carried. He wants Indigenous people to achieve the voice that they've sought, and he says that this should be at all levels of government. But he doesn't necessarily see that voice as being enshrined in the Constitution. He urges the states to take the lead on the treaty process. The expectation on Minister Wyatt will be very high, but he also starts with great goodwill. Ken Wyatt joins us today. Ken Wyatt, you're the first Indigenous Minister for Indigenous Australians, so the issues you're dealing with are very personal to you. Just briefly, can you tell us a little about your own background as an Indigenous Australian?
Well, they're personal because the life I've lived on the other side of the railway line in poverty, but I've had the incredible opportunity of leading in areas of education, Aboriginal lands trust issues in WA and health in New South Wales and Western Australia. So I've seen the impact of the social determinants and the impact of the lack of education and poor health. And that drives me because even in my own family, I have lost two brothers to cancer and then have had a couple of others in the family who have had cancers but are now seeking better treatment than what they used to. So all of these things impact because of family.
And was getting out of poverty a really hard struggle?
Once I finished my high school and went into teacher training, no. That journey was a good one for me. And I made a comment in my maiden speech that when I looked at my father's salary in his last year of working, I was earning much more than him in my first year of teaching. And that really impacted because I suddenly realised how we had lived on a meagre salary that they provided for us. And so the journey has been a good one moving from that context to where I've had good jobs.
Let's talk about the issues you canvassed in your speech. You'd like the constitutional referendum in the next 3 years, but you have given yourself a let out that there needs to be consensus on wording and a high chance of success, and those are high bars. How optimistic are you that, given the differences within Indigenous leadership, within government ranks over this issue, and given Australian suspicions of referenda generally, that you can actually meet those conditions? Your own style's a softly, softly one, but won't you have to bang quite a few heads in the process?
I will. I'll have to bring people with me. I'm optimistic about achieving the outcome because if the words are simple but are meaningful, then Australians will generally accept an opportunity to include Aboriginal people in the Constitution. There'll be naysayers, and I'll work with all of them to hear what their views are because there will be some very strong quarters that will fight this. But if we've got the right tone and the right set of words, and the Prime Minister and Cabinet and my colleagues believe that we've got the opportunity to move forward, then we will.
One of the really big challenges getting a referendum through is to get the support of 4 of the 6 states that's needed to pass it. Now, do you think your home state of Western Australia, which is a pretty conservative place, would be on board?
I think WA will be tough, but there's certainly a growing appetite because of individuals who have done a lot of work on the ground. I see the changes in Victoria, South Australia, and to some extent Queensland. So it's a matter of walking with all the ministers for Aboriginal Affairs and convincing relevant key leadership to come and support constitutional recognition. But I think the corporate sector, particularly the mining companies in WA, will have a tremendous influence given their stance in respect to the statement from the heart.
And so they will be on board and take a leadership role in that state, you think?
I think they will, because they've come out with a video showing that Rio Tinto and BHP are supportive, and Chevron at an event that I was at also indicated. So there's significant leadership within the WA community. Now, if they speak up and bring others with them, then I'm optimistic that we will have a groundswell of support.
So do you think WA is the toughest state, even harder than Queensland?
In the past, I would have said yes, although the 67 referendum, we did well. And we had areas where the vote was extremely high. A couple of areas didn't support. But nevertheless, I think the under 40-year-olds have a strong sense of fairness and social justice. And in our state, that number is increasing.
Now, there have already been extensive consultations on this issue, but is your plan to go back to the beginning on the consultative process or pick it up sort of where it's been recently?
I'm going to pick it up from where the Leasing Dodson report reached, because we agreed to all the recommendations in there. So that's the starting point. And then it is a matter of looking at the opportunities to co-design. Because on the ground, when I chaired the Standing Joint Select Standing Committee and when I was on the expert panel, people were saying constitutional recognition is not our highest priority. It is about access to services, better health, better education, access to good water. And they were pragmatic issues that the community raised, but they said we will support constitutional referendum if it's going to have a benefit to us collectively. And we used the 67 referendum as a concept of where Australia supports this.
So you wouldn't necessarily go back to all these communities again?
No, because I think we've got a good record out of the expert panel, and I'm certainly heavily involved with that. The second two joint select committees did comprehensive work. The work that Mark Liebler and his co-chair Pat Anderson did, which culminated in the Voice from the Heart, and the more recent work of both Dodson and Lisa are invaluable mechanisms to utilise in the way that we work this forward.
Now, I know
what I have to do is bring members of the Australian Parliament with me.
That could be the biggest challenge of all. I know that you don't have a model, but would you call yourself a minimalist when it comes to constitutional change on this issue?
I probably am, in the sense that I know what wording can be used and applied. As I said on Sky, none of us thought about the implications of Section 44 of the Constitution. We thought it was all over, but it sounds like there's another element to it now that was not seen on the surface. So we have to have this in the right context of a structural recognition that doesn't go beyond what the intent was, other than to provide the rule book for which the Commonwealth will respond to in the way that it deals with Aboriginal communities in the future.
But where do you think the majority of Indigenous leaders would be on this question? They surely wouldn't be minimalists, would they?
No, they wouldn't. But we also have to be pragmatic in an age in which social media can have a detrimental impact. What I want is to see us make some gains later on as we mature as a nation. Then we can have another debate of what the next phase is. Because most of the Constitution, when you watch the process in the way in which it was developed and written, it took some time for them to get to the final document and then adopt it through the Act of the British Parliament. So it came into play in Australia. And all reforms have required substantial bipartisan agreement and substantial support, you know, where people felt as though they weren't threatened. And the ones that we've failed on that I remember were because people didn't trust us in Canberra, because we weren't clear in our message, we weren't clear in the purpose and intent. And if they see it as giving more power to Canberra, then they certainly have not supported us in the past when we've had some interesting issues that were put to referenda.
Now, the Uluru Statement from the Heart wanted a First Nations voice enshrined in the Constitution. But in your press club speech, you seem to be suggesting that there were other options for enshrining the voice. Could you just outline your thinking on this at the federal level?
I think we've got an opportunity to have the voice based on local and regional structures, but with a national structure as well. Now, what that looks like, I want to evolve out of the co-design work so that people are comfortable with it, including mainstream Australia, and for it to be able to provide advice to government, like the Productivity Commission does. We table their reports and they have a profound impact.
So it wouldn't necessarily be in the Constitution?
It may not be, but if it's the first step to moving towards a realisation, then I think we should grasp the nettle and grasp that opportunity.
So you're seeing this whole thing as a sort of staged process over perhaps a number of years, right?
Yeah, I think the pragmatic reality, Michelle, is that we're going to have to, because we're moving as a nation on Aboriginal issues on so many fronts that we still have this suspicion by Australians in respect to tinkering with the Constitution. So we have to be on solid and sound ground.
On the matter of treaty, you said in your speech that you saw the states and the territories leading on this. Do you envisage that at some stage there would be a federal treaty, a treaty between the national government and Indigenous people?
Who do you have the treaties with? Working through 250 different cultural groups.
Well, maybe you have it with the voice, with that body.
And that's an option that we could consider. But I want to allow the states to do their work, because we've seen the evolution out of Western Australia with the Barnett government and the potential now for another similar agreement with another group in WA, which the state government's working on. Victoria, who is significantly advanced in their activity on treaty, and the Northern Territory appointing Nick Dodson to look at what's the capacity and potential within the NT. But given it's a territory, that'll have implications for the Commonwealth. So I think we'll see other states eventually make some decisions that move to agreements of some form or another.
We're seeing a lot of talk about bipartisanship from both the government and the opposition at the moment. And we have both you and your counterpart in Labor, Linda Burney, being Indigenous people. I wonder whether this makes it easier to make progress. You both walk in the shoes of the Indigenous community or communities, but is there also tougher pressures on you both from Indigenous people?
The latter is true. There will be tough expectation on both Linda and I, given statements that were made by both of our parties previously. But the expectation in sections of our community that will say, no, we don't want recognition, and others who say, yes, we do, it's how we balance and make the judgments that will assist a direction in which we see recognition occur.
Can we turn now from these issues to some problems of here and now disadvantage faced by Indigenous people? Scott Morrison has set up a National Indigenous Australians Agency. How will this operate differently from the arrangements that went before?
Well, instead of going through the head of Prime Minister and Cabinet, Ray Griggs now is the head of the new agency as the Chief Executive Officer. Mm-hmm. He reports to me. I've also devolved budgets back to the agency because I want a devolution of budgets back to regional managers. So they're in a position to be able to negotiate and work with state and territory governments at the regional level and with Aboriginal communities, and they can make decisions to support or provide funding for joined up government approaches. At the moment, the process has been seeking approval from Canberra, and that's not the way I want to operate.
Despite some progress, obviously Indigenous disadvantage is still a massive problem. The incarceration figures are appalling. Many communities have shocking living conditions and problems that go well beyond money. And recently, of course, a lot of attention has been on youth suicide. Just taking the question of suicide, why do you think the rate is so high and what can be done about it?
I think there is a sense of utility for some young people. The issue of broken relationships, the way in which young people have expressed to me the need for their culture to be valued, that their identity is important. But I've also said, and this is the interesting thing I noted in the Kimberley Coronial Inquiry, was when the number of suicides occurred. So I think we need to look at some of the support structures that need to go into place on the ground. And I'm thinking through a couple of options, which I won't share yet, but I think there is a way that we can cover some of this with existing resources.
You have said you need more around-the-clock services rather than 9-to-5.
That's right. And young people themselves have said 9-to-5 is fine because they've got access to support networks. It's after the 5 o'clock period in which they can't access. And in the Kimberley, the kids have gone to the police and sat with the police and talked through their issue. And that's been a circuit breaker in those instances.
Do you think this feeling of futility is worse than when you were young, when you were the age of these kids? And if so, why?
I'm not sure why that is, because even when I grew up, our lives were governed by Native Welfare Acts. We were controlled by, in WA, the Native Welfare Department. And our lives were very much scrutinised from the external agency. Now you've got kids in a great position to look at a range of options and opportunities, but they're coming, so for example, you come away to a boarding school, you gain your year 12 or high school exit point, but there is nothing at the community in a way of a real job. And that's frustrating for young people.
It's also said that quite a few of those kids who have a very good opportunity to get a good education at a good school in the city feel very sort of lost and alienated from their community, very lonely. Is that a real problem?
That has been a challenge, but what I've seen schools do, and I know a couple in Perth, bring elders down and they live with the kids for a period of time and then there's a swap over. So there's continuity from senior people in guiding young ones who live in capital cities. The concern of the community is losing kids to capital city life. Because they really want them to be skilled as doctors, teachers, and go back and be players within their own communities.
Those programs do seem very successful, but obviously a lot of support is needed at an individual level to get the kids to be able to get through them and make the most of them.
Yeah, there is a level of support and intervention, and we've got some really tremendous programs that the Commonwealth provides funding for, and we've seen successes. I saw at LaSalle College in Perth, a young man who came through, a high school student, he graduated and was the first person ever out of Balgo to graduate. I saw the same in Roebourne, where 5 students exited the final year of school and it had an impact on the community. And we've seen more children in those communities now take education as a opportunity for a better way and gaining knowledge that they need to either give them a career or take them back to their community so that they can impact and change the direction.
Quite a number of schools are running these programs, but would you encourage others to get on board and give scholarships and get these young people through a good education?
I think we're seeing that it's increasing. Like Adam Goods' program is based around Sydney, and what they do is support young students in government schools. So there are varying degrees of intervention that makes a difference. So they've been highly successful. And what we will do is keep building the role models and capability within our communities where it'll become normal to take that journey through schooling, but equally continue to acquire the cultural knowledge.
And this is why the practical needs to go hand in hand with the symbolic, I guess.
That's right, because it is about the practical approaches that will make the difference.
Ken Wyatt, thank you very much for talking with the Conversations Politics podcast today. That's all for this podcast. Thank you to my producer, Rashna Farooq. We'll be back with another interview very soon. Goodbye for now.
Our theme music is by Lee Rosevier. You can find more podcasts from The Conversation on our website at theconversation.com.